Today, let's be done by some poetry.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Recently, I rose in the morning, as I always do, to eat my, I don't know, sometimes cereal, sometimes cornmeal mush now. That's an alternative. And a really good alternative, by the way, if you haven't done it. And either listen to or read my devotional material, which is, a set of scriptures as I'm reading through the Bible. All of that happens at the same time so that I'm in a decent mood. I have to eat while I'm doing my devotional normally. And I rose during all of that time to find a little book on my dining room table where I was sitting doing my devotional. Called The Day, but it had the name John Donne on it. And it found its way there because my wife had been in Salado and she bought this little book at some shop. I don't know what shop. I don't know what attracted her to the book, except maybe the name John Donne. She knows I'm a big fan of John Donne. And it's a book published in 1967. So this is not a current publication. I don't know if you could find a version of this today or not. I did not look that up. Perhaps Daisy will, and if she does, she'll create a link on the website so that you can get to it to find a current version. Again, called The Day by John Donne. This one is illustrated by Tom Goddard. I'm telling you all of that because I want to read the entire book to you. Now, straightforward about it, the book is very, very, very brief. It's just a handful of pages. They're each poems by John Donne. More than that, they're not just poems by John Donne. They are poems offered as a prayer by John Donne after the death of someone he had come to know and trust. And who'd had an influence in his life. I'll tell you about her later. Well, her name is Magdalene Herbert. There's a description of it at the back of the little book. And this little book is put out by the Episcopal Book Club, or was put out by the Episcopal Book Club back in 1967. So again, out of date by far. But it was published in 1967, but it was written in 1627. So we're talking 340-year span. And John Donne is just, he's a huge influence on my thinking, on my way of understanding the world. He's one of the first authors I ever read who crushed me, who humiliated me in regards to the way I had been thinking of the world. It made me realize how shallow my understanding of the world was, and how foolish I was. And this is when I was 18 years old, maybe 19. How foolish I was to have an arrogant view of the world from myself. Oh, I know all these things. Look at all these debates I won and how bright I must be. And then I read John Donne and I was just devastated. It was overwhelming. And what I read was the poem I have shared with you many times before. When we were on the radio, I did it quite a few times. And I brought it up, talked through parts of it, and one time actually read it on air and talked through the poem itself. But it's Batter My Heart, Three-Person God. That's what most people know of John Donne. That's one of the most famous poems that he has. Others would be of a completely different style. The Flea, for instance, is the other super famous poem that he has. And then one that I'll read to you in a little bit, Death Be Not Proud. I'll read to you in a moment. But I just reading it, being exposed to it, really transformed me. So he became a hero for me. He was this figure about whom everything I could know or learn was just fascinating. Now, I'm not an obsessive person about things like that, so it's not like I went out and did a bunch of research on John Donne. I didn't. But every time I heard something about him, I tucked it away. And it became part of my lore about a man whose encounter with God was so profoundly transformative and who experienced that encounter not only spiritually and metaphysically. It transformed his life, and it transformed his expressions, his understanding of the cosmos. It did all of that, but also a man who understood it intellectually. He and lived in that. And so it was just, extremely invigorating for me and motivating to try to understand the things that he wrote. So I've always been able to go back to John Donne, and I can hardly read a poem of his without just being brought to tears. You know, it's just amazing. So I woke up this morning, this morning recently that I was talking about, and I found this little book on the table, and I had just been listening, and on that day I was just listening to my scriptures. And so I had listened through the chapters that I was going to read for that day from Scripture, and then I thought, oh, well, look at this. And what is this? Oh, it's poems. Oh, it's not just poems. These are something that was offered as a prayer, an excerpt from the prayer before the sermon. This is the title page description of this book, an excerpt from the prayer before the sermon preached by John Donne, Dean of St. Paul's, London, at the commemoration of the gracious Lady Magdalene Danvers. This would be commemoration, would be memorial service. In the parish church of Chelsea on 1 July 1627. That is after she had passed away, but it's when he was able to offer this invocation on her behalf. And so, or at least in memory of her. And so I picked it up and I opened it and I started reading it. And it has these stylistic, highly stylized illustrations that go with it. From historical images of Christianity, so you know they were there. So it's an attractive little book. So I opened it up and I began to read, and I read the first word, and immediately tears were just falling on the table in front of me, and it was just it's a moving thing. So we'll get to the words, believe me, not yet, probably not today, not in this episode, because I'm going to read you some other things from John Donne first, and they'll take a moment. But I will say it is, so my heroes are all dead. And I like that. Not that they're dead. So to be clear, I'm not like a fan of death. I know death is the last enemy to be defeated. We'll be talking a lot about death during these Donne poems. He was heavily affected by his really common and profound encounters with death itself. So that actually does inform a lot of this discussion. But what I mean by it is, you know, having a living hero is a risky thing because heroes let you down, you know, and once somebody dies, you put them in the ground, it's, you know, unlikely. It's not impossible that you're going to learn something about them that's disappointing, but, you know, it's unlikely they're going to come out of the grave and do something that's disappointing. So unlikely, like not going to happen. So, you know, having a dead hero is, helpful, I think. And honestly, I've had people that I, you know, veneration is too strong a term, but it's that, that I venerated who, living in this world, who did disappoint me and made me realize, let's wait and see the end product. Not meaning I wouldn't learn from somebody, not meaning I wouldn't admire someone, but I mean that, you know, so people could call it hero worship. I don't mean that. Obviously, it's not okay to worship anyone. We know everyone's fallible, including John Donne, who I'll talk about today. But there is a sense in which we venerate certain people. We recognize that their contribution was so great that they are something of a model of what we want our lives to be like. And if you know, if all of this makes you uncomfortable because in a supercilious sense, you believe it's, you know, we shouldn't follow any man. We should only follow Christ, the man, you know, so on. Then, you know, I would simply reiterate the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 11. Be followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. And he doesn't say that because he's a special apostle. He says that because he's following Christ. And the author of Hebrews makes it clear that we're supposed to do the same with the people who set the example for us in Hebrews 13. And we consider the end of their lifestyle in order to decide to follow them. So, yeah, I have a hero, and it's John Donne. And I have others that I admire in similar ways, but for other reasons. So I, you know, René Descartes is something of a hero for me. No problem. Immanuel Kant, bad as he is in some ways, is in terms of his ethical theory something of a hero for me, because the ideology he establishes allows for this flourishing development of the ideas around the golden rule. And so I, you know, I can point out a number of people like that. When I read them, I still put a filter on. I know there are things wrong with Immanuel Kant. I know there are things wrong with René Descartes. I still put a filter on, but I just rely on, find an anchor in some of the examples that they give. But theirs are intellectual. Theirs are just intellectual. They are intellectual heroes for me. And again, even in terms of the certain values that they espouse, I might not agree with everything. That's fine. I can filter all that out. I could pick out a handful of people who are like that, who have passed away, but they are heroes of intellectual introspection or intellectual philosophical perspectives or whatever. John Donne is different, though. John Donne is different because his power with language and metaphor married to his deep devotional commitment to Christ, to what Christ meant to him, it's just overwhelming. It's a beautiful model. And so, of course, I know he wasn't perfect, and I know that even in his religious commitments, I would have disagreed with him about certain things. But the poetry he writes and the encounters that he has with these metaphysical truths that he then conveys in this language that just unearths the deepest parts of my own intellect, but also my own heart and soul, it's just so compelling. So I picked up the book and started reading and started weeping because it was like meeting my hero. But, you know, people always say you never want to meet your heroes because they'll disappoint you is the idea. But, you know, having a dead hero, you know, you have an advantage. And so I was meeting John Donne, and as I started reading into the poem, the prayer that he offered, which is a poem, as I started reading into the poem, immediately I realized how much of it was emerging from Psalm 116. Which is my favorite psalm and has been for ages. I mean, it's just such a powerful and compelling psalm about death, but about everything that we're supposed to understand about life because of what we understand about death in it. And he starts using this language about it in a way that I don't hear anybody else use and that has been so deeply embedded in my way of understanding that psalm. It was just overwhelming. And so I just want to share reading that with you. But to get to it, I also want to share enough of a couple of other poems, just a couple. And this is my goal for today, at least to get through these two poems, so that you can understand why I trust his encounters with death. And I mean by that, he's not treating it lightly. He's not treating it as something to say to others. He is swimming in a world where he has been doused in these encounters with death and the suffering and the grief that goes with it. And not just in a formal pastoral sense. He is a minister, you know, by this time. Not just that, but in a personal sense. I mean, he has encountered it and not encountered it shallowly. Oh, well, they're in a better place. But in the deepest sort of how long, Lord, do we have to wait until you make things right? And so I just wanted to give you a couple of other examples. One, his most famous poem about death, Death Be Not Proud, which we'll read today. And we'll read these in the same sense that I've read poetry in the past, in a previous episode, a couple of times. We've read some key poems, one about Veterans Day and understanding the losses of war, and another just doing some poetry from a period just before John Donne. But when we get to John Donne and who are called the metaphysical poets, the other poets along with him who are referred to as the metaphysical poets, you know, the writing changes entirely. Instead of having what I would regard as somewhat simplistic, they're not simplistic, they're beautiful, but they're very direct metaphors and images about things that are obtainable in this world and that you can see in the world, including really deep experiences. So again, it's very rich. All of that poetry is powerful, but when you get to the metaphysical poets, as they're referred, to the 17th century British poets who were metaphysical poets, man, the complexity and depth of not just the imagery, but also the content of what they're addressing in the universe is just so profound. So the poem, first poem I want to share with you, is from his Holy Sonnets. So his most famous poems are the Holy Sonnets. That's normally where people go to read John Donne. And one of his Holy Sonnets, I think this one is numbered 17. I'm not sure. Daisy, you may have to double check that to make sure the number is right. But if I remember correctly, this is Holy Sonnet 17, and it's called "Since She Whom I Loved Hath Paid Her Last Debt." That's the reference, the title reference. And it's taken from the first line. His poems are generally this way. In the Holy Sonnets, it's Holy Sonnet number such and such. And then as a title, you just use the first line. At least that's what I remember of it. So here's this poem. And this is because John Donne writes some pretty racy poetry in his younger years, you know, before he's devotionally committed and so on like that. And in those years, he also marries scandalous. So he's even imprisoned for it for a little while. But it's passionate. So, and that's why it was sort of scandalous. Like he's gonna marry this woman no matter what. And he apparently just really loved her. You know, he was just so enamored of her. And they had many children together. And eventually, after many, like a dozen children that they had together, only some of whom lived to adulthood, as was sort of normal in that day. But after one of those children's births, she died shortly thereafter. And so he writes this poem in the wake of her death. Now, I don't know if he penned it shortly afterwards or if he writes it just remembering it. But here's the poem he writes about the loss of his love. And I'm reading this to you before I get to the book of poems that turn into the prayer about another woman later in his life who dies, and he writes a memorial service for her. I'm reading this to you so you can have a sense of the way he encounters death and deals with his encounters with death through poetry and in the poems an expression of his faith, you know? So here's this poem as John Donne offers it to us, Holy Sonnet, number 17. Since, this is how it goes. Since she whom I loved hath paid her last debt to nature, and to hers and my good is dead, and her soul early into heaven ravished, holy in heavenly things, my mind is set. That's the first stanza. This is a sonnet, so we're looking at quatrains, four lines at a time. Those are the first four lines. Here, second stanza begins. The admiring her mind did whet to seek thee, God. So streams do show the head. But though I have found thee, and thou my thirst hast fed, a holy thirsty dropsy melts me yet. But why should I beg more love, whenas thou dost woo my soul, for hers offering all thine? And dost not only fear lest I allow my love to saints and angels, things divine, but in thy tender jealousy dost doubt lest the world, flesh, yea, devil, put thee out. This is a magnificent poem. I'm not going to try to exposit the whole thing for you or something like that, but you know, the imagery is so powerful and the reference is so clear. You can tell in the first stanza, you know, with the death of this wife, this woman that he loved so much, he just says, you know, since she has paid her last debt And now she is taken to heaven. She's been stolen from the earth, ravished away from us. Then I've set my entire mind on heaven. But his mind is drawn toward heaven by her rapture, by her being captured away to it. And then he follows that by saying, there's still something here that leaves me melting, collapsing under the weight of it. And it is streams of glory, but it's also something painful and lost in the second stanza. And then in the third stanza, and of course there are three quatrains and then a couple of more lines. In the last quatrain, he says, so you are drawing my attention, not that I would seek some other love in this world, not that I would be drawn to obsess about a love lost in this world, but you are drawing me to love you, to be attracted only to you and to know you. And so he draws his conclusion with the lines, but in thy tender jealousy dost doubt lest the world, flesh, yea, devil, put thee out. Don't let any of the other things that attract me create a barrier between me and the thing you want my heart to be drawn to, and that you drew my heart to, not only through the love that I had with my spouse, but more importantly, through the love of her that drew my attention to heaven when I lost her. That's an amazing image. There's a lot more in it, in the poem, and I'm not pretending I know all of the things that are weighed out in this poem. But when you read that, you get a sense of just how powerfully he's moved by the experience of death, but also shaped in his faith by his encounter with mortality. And that's the thing that happens with a John Donne that makes him so distinctive. I read to you in an episode much earlier, a long time ago, a poem by Ben Jonson about the death of his son, in which he's also stirred in the gravity and meaning of death. And his poetry is also beautiful regarding that. But in John Donne, you have sort of materialized or made fully mature this. You know, I was telling someone at work just recently, well, I was telling Daisy just the other day, how often we see college students come in. And of course, they come in as 18-year-olds. You know, these are optimistic and, you know, everything is all glistening violins and candles and a future of glory. And everybody, you know, feels that way when they're young, not everyone, but a lot of students do. And how often you watch and you see them mature. And there's the maturing that comes with, you know, guys having shoulders when they didn't before and things like that. There's all of that. But there's also the maturity that comes with a change in the look of the eyes. And I expressed it in one sense as, you know, I watch them become more jaded. And that's a little too negative. I don't really mean it that way. But become more aware, so as Daisy said it, more realistic in their outlook on the world. That's true too, and I do see that. And we see that in, I mean, every human being goes through that. The longer you live, the more encounters with the painful things of the world you have. And the more you have those, the more they become sort of built into your understanding of how to deal with the world. Some people become cynical because of that. Others become just more guarded. Some live in denial, you know, optimistic no matter what. And in that denial, they find it. And that's part of dealing with the realistic losses that are always had in this world. Anyway, all of those, you know, that whole range of responses is possible just psychologically. So that's just us as human beings. What sets John Donne apart in my encounters with him, in my experience with him, and I don't know that I ever fully processed how important this was to me until I read this little book, The Day, the prayer that he offers at this memorial service. But in reading that, it really stirred in me and reminded me why I value his reaction so much, because he lost so much. I mean, he faced one sorrow after another throughout his life. including in those encounters with his loved one, with his wife, where he was arrested and wasn't going to be able to stay connected to her and so on. It's one huge challenge after another. And then when they are together and they start having children, they have children who perish. And it's not a light experience. Even when it's had more commonly in their day, it doesn't change the reality of the pain of that loss. And so he's experiencing all these very, just weighty losses. And yet what comes out of it is this adamantly, solidly positioned poet, pastor, minister, thinker who is unwavering in his commitment to faith and to God, and is able to stand when waves are crashing against him like this lighthouse shining out a light and saying, yes, there are rocks here. Yes, there are corpses here. But yes, there is light here, and there is hope here as well. And it's a great beacon of testimony in my own experiences to be able to read how he manages to work through those realities. And so the other poem I wanted to read to you in preparation for reading the day, which again, I intend to read to you in the next episode. And all of this, the season. So all of this anticipating the Easter celebration that we have in the resurrection, because he does find his hope in the resurrection, which is obvious as I'm reading to you the next poem, Death Be Not Proud, in just a moment. As I'm reading to you this sonnet, which is Holy Sonnet 10, it's obvious that he's relying on the resurrection as his place of hope. And this is what's built into our Christianity. There is no version of Christianity in Scripture that says, well, in this life, this is the only hope that we have. There is no version of Christianity that says that. And we've talked through 1 Corinthians 15 before, the passage that gets a little confusing to people because I think they lose the tenor of the argument. They lose the whole really string of the argument in the middle of it, where he says, if in this life only we have hope, we are of all men most miserable. You know, that statement that people have, they sort of lose the sense of the meaning of that in the context of the argument because they think it means, well, if you only hope in this life and you're a Christian, you lose everything. You don't have any joy whatsoever. That's not the meaning of that at all. And I'm not going to go through the reason that's not the meaning, but the meaning is not that. The meaning is actually, of course, your life is changed in this world as well. And of course, it's changed for the better in this world so that you have reason to celebrate Christ for what he does in your life here. But the reason, the celebration of the change he makes in our life here is so valid is because of our understanding of things that are not bound to this life. And this would be true with or without a resurrection. For the Jews who held the view that there was no resurrection, they still realized the value of the things that you gave yourself to that weren't about you just obtaining some success in this world, but instead handing things down to the next generation and valuing the things that endured beyond your life. And that's good, and it's beautiful. But beyond that, built into Christianity is an understanding that the resurrection brings this assurance that the eternal things we'd been pursuing in this life were worthwhile, and that they become a part of our being beyond this world, beyond the limitations of this temporal experience. And so that's a huge part of what John Donne is building in to this poem. So this one is Death Be Not Proud. Of course, you know the language from Stephen Crane and his use of it. And it puts in context that John Donne has a background that is military, and he knows the encounters with death that come there as well. But in this case, he shares it generically about death itself. So here's the statement. Death, this is the opening line of the poem. death, be not proud, which is, by the way, a provocative opening to a sonnet, since it's not iambic. You know, it's this stoichic, abrupt confrontation with the language at the beginning of the poem. Death, be not proud. Though some have, it's like a confrontation, like he's already punched death in the face just with the opening four words. Death, be not proud. Though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, they die not. I inserted the they. That's not acceptable in poetry. It's almost impossible for me not to paraphrase sometimes. So I'm going to read it to you again, the line. But it's just such a great line. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure, then from thee much more must flow. And soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell. And poppy or charms can make us sleep as well and better than thy stroke. Why swellest thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. Obviously, it's again hard for me to read John Donne without being affected. Sorry about that. Hard to avoid. But the opening quatrain is obvious. Death, don't be so proud. You think you're so great, but the people you're overthrowing don't die. You think it lasts forever, but it doesn't. It doesn't last forever. They die not. And then he's so sarcastic about it because death, you know, this overlord with the scythe, and I'm using the imagery we use, you know, as a caricature. Death, this overlord with the scythe, staring down with such power, is claiming such authority over us. And his last line to it is, oh, don't be so proud. Death, be not proud. Because those who you think you overthrow, they die not, poor death. It's his way of patting death on the head and saying, oh, you poor little fool. You think you have such great power over us, but you can't kill me. And then he gives the second quatrain, the second set of four verses, and he says four lines, and it says, from rest and sleep, which are just your pictures. And there are pictures that Paul uses. Oh, you know, some sleep, meaning they die. So when a person is sleeping, we think of them as in an image of death, a little image or foreshadowing of what death would be. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, there comes much pleasure. So we sleep, and then we wake up, and we're refreshed. And when we're resting, we're glad that we're finally able to rest. Well, imagine then, from these brief sleeps, where we open our eyes and we finally feel refreshed, imagine then, from the sleep, from the rest that comes from laying down your body and never having to worry about its pains again, imagine the delivery of the soul that comes from that rest. And so, you know, our best men, they go to you with their bones and find soul's delivery. They wake up completely refreshed. And then the third stanza is the best one. This is the patting the poor dog on the head. I know you think you're important, but I mean, come on. You are slave to fate. You're slave to chance. People die by accident. You're slave because a king decides to cut off someone's head. They die. You didn't choose it. The king chose it. You didn't choose it. Chance chose it. Fate chose it. Desperate men. What am I going to do? I'll stab this person. Somebody dies because some man is desperate. You think you're powerful? These nobodies around here are throwing you around like you're nothing at all. They use poison and war and sickness. That's where you live. If you think of an impoverished London and people going to the poorest part of town where there is sickness, or people journeying through a war zone where there's just misery and all you want to do is not be there. And John Donne is really insulting death here by saying, where do you live? You live in all the places we don't want to be. Nobody likes you. There's nothing good about you. You don't choose your own ends. You're not doing anything permanent, and nobody wants to be with you. You're ugly, and your mother dresses you funny, basically. So you live with poison and war and sickness. And, by the way, as powerful as you think you are, we can use opium. We can use opium or some charms, and they can give us a better sleep than you do. Then why are you so proud? After all, we lay down to sleep with you just for one short moment, and we wake up forever, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. That line, the beginning of it, death, be not proud. And then the closing of it, death, thou shalt die. You can hear how they're made to match. Why should death be not proud? Because death dies, and then what's the conclusion of it? See, the whole point is we're dying. Yeah, we're dying all around, everywhere, by every means possible. We're dying. But we die, and we wake up. And we wake up to what? Never die again. That's the resurrection. And so in his statement, death be not proud, he doesn't just say, because you experience what everybody else experiences. He says to death, all of these other deaths, we're just going to sleep for one moment. And then we wake eternally. And death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. In truth, death is the only thing that really dies. It's the thing that's left with no power whatsoever. And we feel like we're the ones who are left without when death has come and taken its great stroke. So it's really just a magnificent poem turning death on its head, humiliating this powerful figure, putting it down into a lower state, and then saying, even the little things you think you're accomplishing with us are actually serving our end. You give us a brief rest, and then we wake up refreshed and ready for eternity. And you're the only one lying there still and dead when everything is done, because death, thou shalt die. Let's be more done or undone in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.